Structure is the first tool that we're going to hand to you as we consider this task that we've been given of trying to stay on the line. This tool is going to help us stay on the line, help us to say God's words after him. And today we're going to hear about structure, and then Curtis is going to share about connecting to the gospel later this afternoon, correct? And one of the things that's so fun is, if you're anything like me, I had my first day of Simeon Trust Workshop, and then I was like, I want to go home and redo my worksheet. Because I realized, oh, there are some ways of understanding structure and connecting to the gospel that I just wasn't aware of. And so anyway, all that to say is, if you have that, feel free to do that. Because we're going to be talking about structure right now, and then later, theological reflection connecting to the gospel. If you were to come across a pile of bones, how would you know what those bones were supposed to signify? You know, when I draw for my kids, because I'm a very terrible artist, I basically draw stick figures. So if you were to encounter stick figure bones like this, how would you know what it was that you were supposed to create with it? How would you know? You find all these things. Like, okay, what is that supposed to signify right there? Well, it's not immediately clear, is it? But you need to figure out something to do with all of this. Mortimer Adler said that every book is a skeleton hidden between its covers, and that your job as an analytical reader is to find it. A book comes to you with flesh on its bare bones and clothes over its flesh. It's all dressed up. You do not have to undress it or tear its flesh off its limbs to get at the firm structure that lies under its soft surface. But you must read the book with X-ray eyes, for it is an essential part of your apprehension of any book to grasp its structure. That's from Mortimer Adler's How to Read a Book. Our job is, as expositors, is to discern not just the bones of the passage, but to show how our bones fit together. So as you've come to a passage, you're like, you don't want to then come to your people and be like, hey, as you take a look at this passage, you need to know there's a head there, and there's a spine there, and there's some arms and legs there. You need to actually put this together for your people so that they understand what this text is signifying. Because it may be that these things sort of come together and, you know, you have this, right? But it may be that you were supposed to put the bones together like this. It was actually, you know, a dog. This is how I draw a dog, okay? This is dog. Dog. Maybe just ears. Maybe there was also this here, you know, this is the ears. You have to know how to put it together, or else it's just not going to be comprehensible. And if the bones themselves are supposed to be put together in a certain sort of way, you've got to know how to do that as a good reader of the text, so that what you present to your people is a faithful representation of what the author was actually trying to get across to you or to me. And so therefore, we come to our principle for today, which is we must discover the structure of a passage to discern its emphasis. We must discover the structure of a passage to discern its emphasis. Again, our job is not to just say, hey, church, I found a skull bone, a spine bone, a leg bone, and an arm bone in this text. It's to tell them how those fit together so that they can understand what this passage is all about, to reveal the emphasis of the original author. There are three text types in the Bible. There is narrative, there is poetry, and there is discourse. And as you have been engaged in your preparation in the book of Amos, narrative, discourse, poetry. Where do we find narrative in the book of Amos? Yeah, oh, Dave knows.
Chapter 7, there's a chat between the guys that talk about stuff.
Chapter 7 gives us a little bit of narrative in the chat between the guys that tell us stuff. I love that. Thank you, Dave. Where do we find discourse in the book of Amos? Also chapter 7. We get a little bit of narrative in chapter 7. We get a little bit of discourse in chapter 7. Where do we get poetry in Amos? We get it in chapter 7, yeah. And we get it everywhere. So the prophets are dominated by poetry. And one of the things that makes prophets so hard for us is that poetry is hard. It's hard to understand poetry. It's hard to understand poetry in English that's been written within the last 100 years that you are pretty close to. It's really hard to understand poetry that was written thousands of years ago in another language. And the prophets almost exclusively talk in poetry. And that means that our task is really hard. That means that especially our structure work in our worksheets, there are going to be places for us to make progress because poetry is hard. Ancient poetry is harder. Ancient poetry that's being used as prophetic utterance is even harder. It's the hardest of all of them. And so for those of you who are here for the first time, well done. You started Simeon on hard mode, so I respect you for that. This is probably the hardest genre that you'll try to discern the structure of. And it's important for us to start with that because it should encourage you to make progress, because all of us should be able to make progress in this most challenging of genres. I wonder, knowing that we're going to be focusing on poetry, which is everywhere in the book of Amos and everywhere in the prophets in general, call out to me just some ways, some strategies for us discerning the structure of a passage of poetry, of prophecy that is poetry. What are some strategies for understanding poetry?
Parallelism,
yeah. Repetition is huge. Explain to me what you mean by that. I think that's a helpful thing to say, because one of the things that you can note is, especially as you take a look at different verses, sometimes those verses will intensify as you're taking a look at poetry. Yeah, so poetic intensification. Simile, figures of speech. How would you use these to sort of discern how a structure is emerging as you're reading a poetic text? Yes, so as you see something like repetition, you can underline words and phrases. And one of the things that's really helpful is that you can do this to start discerning what the stanzas are in these poems, in these songs that these prophets are singing are. If you see something repeated a bunch of different times, maybe at the end of a period of the prophet speaking, you realize, oh, that's a verse. That's a verse of poetry. That's kind of being blocked off by the fact that there's repetition that's happening. That's really, really helpful. And so actually, to kind of illustrate that, I just want to show you that this is a helpful way of discerning what a stanza is, taking a look at the repetition, noting where it takes place. Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 8. And I want you to briefly, with a partner, read this out loud together. I'll give you a couple of minutes. And just answer the question, why are there four stanzas here in Isaiah 9, verse 8 through 10, verse 4? So read it out loud with your partner. Just answer very simply, why is it that there are four stanzas here? All right, so making use of this tool of repetition, how do you know that there should be four stanzas here? Yes, in the back. Yes, that's right. That's right. So there's this repetition that takes place at the end of each one of these stanzas. For all this is anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. Or in the translation the brother shared with us, his hand is still raised to strike. Now this is helpful, right? Because you see this repetition, and you recognize, okay, so something is happening at the end of each stanza, at the end of each verse in this poem, in this song that the prophet is singing. And knowing that you probably have four sections then, because the repetition repeats four times at the end of four different sections, enables you to begin the work of structure. You found the bones. You found the bones of the passage. You've been the architect who has dug up the bones, and they're laying in front of you. And then you can start doing the work of how those passages relate to each other. We're not going to do that right now, because that's going to take too long. Okay, we're going to do that in the next passage, where we're going to spend more time together. But one of the things that you would discover as you start taking a look at Isaiah 9 is that, like the brother over here said, the sins start intensifying to the point where they're instantiated in law by the end, and yet the Lord is not absent from all of this. His hand is still raised to strike. You're already on your way to a sermon that's going to be very clear and tied and connected to the structure that you've been given, because you know you've discerned these bones through repetition, you've found the verses, and therefore, you can start figuring out how they relate to each other. So repetition is a great... Uh-oh, have we gotten to the end of... I can't edit anymore. We might have to start over.
Put now, the pencil on the top to resync it.
I don't know if it's syncing. It said that you're almost out of data. And now we're in read-only mode. I'll tell you what, you've already been given so much information that we're going to get there. Where was I? Oh yeah, talk about strategy of trying to discern structure. Repetition is going to be really key. And in poetry, pay attention to changes. Changes in speaker. Changes in content, sometimes changes in text type. You mentioned Amos 7, it's like, well, something's happening there because all of a sudden we have narrative and we have discourse, we don't have poetry, something's taking place. Take a look at changes or shifts in grammar. And related to speakers, you know, like, pay attention to the pronouns. All right? To take a look at all of that, I'd love for you to turn with me to Micah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Micah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Let's try to figure out what our stanzas are here in Micah 6, 1 through 8. Let's look for the stanza of a shift in voice, a shift in the speaker, in the voice, in the pronouns, in who is speaking. And so what I want for us to do is to try to map the different stanzas of this song based upon the person who is speaking. Take a few minutes with your partner to read Micah 6, verses 1 through 8, and note the speaker. And if the speaker is using first or second person pronouns, and then also note the shifts, okay? Does that make sense? Pay attention to speaker, pronouns, and where the shifts are. And take 4 or so minutes, and we'll come back, and I'll see if we've discerned where the shifts are in this particular text. Go for it. All right, it sounds like you guys are starting to arrive at some conclusions here. And I would love if together we could map out where all the shifts are in this particular text. Does somebody want to share kind of what they came to with their partner? Just want to stand and offer it to us? If not, I can just ask the group. Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. What's your name, sir?
Roger.
Roger, thank you for being willing to offer this to us.
All right, so in verses 1 to 2, it's the prophet who is speaking. And then verses 3 through 5, it's the Lord speaking directly. And then verses 6 through 8, it is again the prophet speaking.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Does everyone agree with the shifts that we've arrived at here?
Six and seven is first person, the pronouns, and verse 8 is he has shown you second person. So I think you could tease out 6 and 7 as being the hearer, maybe Israel, and then verse 8 would be back to the prophet.
I think that that's right. I think that, and what do you note about the pronouns in each section? What do we see in verses 1 and 2? What are the pronouns that are offered here? Plead your case. Hear you, mountains, and you, enduring fountains of the earth. We have you. In verses 3 through 5, what do we have?
3 and 4, first person, verse 5 is second.
We have, in verses 3 through 5, we have my, indicating that there's a speaker. Now, he will also insert you and you, but what's dominant here is my, I, which indicates a shift, right? What do we have in verses 6 through 7? I. And what do we have in verse 8? You and your. So we do note that there are pretty substantial shifts that happen here, here, and here. Shifts in voice or the pronouns that take place there, which indicate that there's some kind of progression that's happening here. Okay, well, if we've sort of done this work as our group here, and we've realized, all right, there are these shifts which lead to there being these kinds of stanzas, let's think through what's happening in each successive group to try to figure out what this structure is pointing to, what kind of emphasis this structure is pointing to. How do each of these shifts relate? What's happening in each movement here? And for that, let me just maybe kind of help us by how I'm going to read verses 1 and 2 here, and then I'm going to give you some time with your group to just summarize for me the content of each particular movement. So chapter 6 begins with, "Hear what the Lord says, arise, plead your case before the mountains, let the hills hear your voice, hear you mountains, the indictment of the Lord, and you enduring fountains of the earth, for the Lord has an indictment against his people, and he will contend with Israel." All right, so with your partner, I want for you to take a look at this structure that we've just come up with, these four different sections that we have delineated together by noting the shifts. And I want for you to summarize what is happening in each stanza. Give me one sentence that you write down on each stanza, and in a couple of minutes we'll come back and share them. All right, I'm seeing people putting down their pencils. I'm seeing people look up at me like, hey, when are we going to continue? And so I think we could start continuing. Give me a summary, maybe a one-sentence summary of what's happening in verses 1 and 2. Yes. What tells you that you're in a court of law here?
And it's interesting that they're not pleading to the Lord, but they're pleading to the Lord's creation. You know, the mountains, the hills, plead your cause.
Well, yes, so this is actually a very common thing that the prophets will do, is they will invite all creation to be the jury in the case that God is about to lay out against the people. So the covenantal lawyers, the prophets, will often do this sort of thing where they will invite heaven and earth, or sometimes they'll invite the mountains to be the judges in the case that God is about to lay out to the people. And you've exactly correctly identified what's happening in verses 1 and 2. We have a courtroom setting, and the prophet, who we have discerned already in our work, is speaking for God, and he's saying, I'm the lawyer, the covenantal lawyer on God's behalf, and I'm going to lay out the case, and creation is going to be the witness. So with that, with us realizing, all right, so that's what the first speaker is doing here in this first stanza. What does that lead us then to recognize is happening in the second stanza? Who did we say was speaking here? The Lord is. And so in this courtroom setting, what is the Lord doing then? Yes. Yes. The Lord is prosecuting his case here in this second section. And what is the prosecution's case? Somebody just call it out. What's the Lord offering here as his case? Well, the Lord has laid out all the stuff that he's done. I have done all of this for my people. All right, so then we have another shift. And we recognize as a group that once we get to 6 and 7, there's somebody new who's speaking, right? It's the hearer, it's the people of Israel who are now speaking. And in this courtroom setting, what are the people of Israel offering? Yes. Which shows that they, what do you say? Yeah, exactly. They're trying to settle the case. They're like, all right, we recognize you have a strong case. Let's settle. What do we need to pay you in order to settle this case? And they offer increasingly ridiculous settlement offers, don't they? Hey, how about I offer you a burnt offering? And then they realize that God's not going to settle for a burnt offering. And then they're like, all right, well, if not a burnt offering, how about we offer you a 1-year-old calf? And then they realize God's not going to settle for a 1-year-old calf. And then it really gets ridiculous. What about 10,000 rivers of oil? Yeah, you have 10,000 rivers of oil? And then, well, what about my child? But then there's another shift. What happens at the end of a court scene? What's issued? The verdict. And knowing that that's the case, and seeing that that's happening with our structure, where does the structure direct our attention? What's the most climactic moment in a court? The verdict. And so where is the structure directing our attention here? To the verdict, to verse 8. And the structure is realizing God's not going to settle. He's going to issue the verdict in terms of what he demands from his people. Okay. So, in about, 15 minutes here, we've just done this work, and the structure has helped us to understand exactly what's transpiring between God and his people in verses 1 through 8. And this can help us get at the author's original intention. And so what I would love from all of us is for us to take maybe 2 minutes and individually or with your partner, write down a brief sentence that might describe what the original author is doing here in Micah 6. And I'm going to ask you to share those sentences in about 2 minutes. And please understand, this is provisional, right? So, I'm not looking for perfection. I'm looking for an offering so that we can together make progress, right? All right, sounds good. We'll make it a burnt offering, yeah. The next person will offer a calf, a one-year-old calf. Once you've gotten a sentence written, if you could just, sort of look up my way so I get a sense of how many people would be ready to engage in this next part. All right, even if this is in rough provisional form, I'm going to give you 15 more seconds, and then I'm going to ask for some folks to share. If you could just wrap it up in 15 seconds. All right, who has a sentence they'd be willing to be brave enough to share with us? Yes, great.
The Lord has established himself as the covenant keeper and identified Israel as the covenant breaker, issuing a verdict for their disobedience and failure to keep his righteous commands.
I think that's excellent. Now, as you would shape that for the argument that you're going to preach to your people, you'd want to sort of narrow that. But I think that's excellent. Anybody else? Yeah.
Remember the mighty works of the Lord, so you can forsake your pitiful works and do what the Lord requires of you.
I love that too. That reflects each of those movements, right? Like remembering the works of the Lord, the pitiful works, the kind of bargaining of the people. And do justice. Yes?
Do what the Lord requires, obedience is better than sacrifice.
Yes, so that ties it to the sacrifice that they're offering, and there's actual obedience that's demanded. This is all really good. Thank you, brothers, for the work that you're doing here. And one of the things that I hope that you're seeing is that it's our structure work that's helping us make advancements. Now, if we were to have just read those first 8 verses, if you were anything like me and I was reading Micah 6, 1 through 8, I was like, I have no idea what's happening here, but I know I'm supposed to do justice, right? And so the argument, if I was like, all right, what's the author arguing? Do justice. But what's helpful is that once we do our structure work, we start getting way more specific. And then it becomes much easier. I'm walking in front of this now. It becomes way easier for us to engage in the task of preaching when we have that level of specificity about what our author is arguing. Now, if I'm preparing a text and I'm like, all right, so the text just says do justice. How do I preach that? And it's probably going to be like, all right, well, what is justice and what does that mean in that context and what does it mean in our context? But if instead I've broken it down into these stanzas, I'm aware that, oh, this is a courtroom setting. This destroys moralism, right? Because right away at the very beginning, we see that this is in the context of God articulating the redemptive acts that he has already done for his people. So it destroys moralism. It reveals the attitude of religion apart from God, doesn't it? As I'm preaching all of this in the third part, reveals fallen religion. Because I can be like, all right, so what's the typical response to grace? Oh, I'm gonna get even. I'm gonna get even with God. I'm gonna settle out of court with God. I'm going to figure out a way that I can pay him back for what it is that he's done. But it doesn't matter how ridiculous the bargaining gets, it's not sufficient to meet what God has done. And so what do I have to hear? What do you have to hear? We have to hear the verdict. That we're actually called to a wholehearted following of God in justice and in mercy and in walking with him. Covenant faithfulness. And so all of a sudden, when so much of my work for my sermon is laid out for me, and I realize, okay, there are 4 points in the text. It makes the most sense for me to reflect that in my own homiletical outline, to have 4 points in the homiletical outline that I'm putting together. And it enables me to avoid moralistic preaching of all of this. And it gets us to a sentence. Here's the sentence that I came up with all of this. Because God has already graciously redeemed his people, he rejects ritual bargaining and requires covenant faithfulness. So this passage then, the structure helps us with all of that. Okay, I see that we've got enough time for us to begin. Oh, man. I'm thankful for the time we took in this. I'm trying to think about how we do Amos 6 in enough. You know what? Let's do this. Turn to Amos 6. I want us to spend at least a little bit of time in Amos. And with a partner, take about 4 to 5 minutes to endeavor to find what the stanzas are of Amos 6 by especially making use of shifts. Amos 6, all of it. Think about shifts. And use that to try to find the stanzas of Amos 6 in particular. So let me give you, 4 to 5 minutes. You can start now, and we'll conclude with this sort of exercise. I'll try to bring it home for us briefly before a little time for Q&A. With your partner, discern the stanzas by making use of shifts. All right, let me give you 30 more seconds, and then I'm going to see if we can delineate what the stanzas are of this based upon the shifts that take place in Amos 6. Okay. Who'd be willing to share with us where we think the stanzas are in this particular chapter based upon the shifts that we see take place? Preferably somebody that hasn't spoken yet in this instruction. Who's got some stanzas for us with shifts? Yeah.
1 to 3, 4 to 7.
And what's the shift that you see after 1 to 3?
I see that he's talking to you in 1 to 3.
Hmm.
And then 4 goes there.
Uh-huh. Great. Continue.
And then after 8 to 11.
And what's the shift you see? Yeah. And I mean, it's a shift from you to they to himself, for sure. The thing you might also note, I don't know if it's the same in yours, but at least in my ESV, it sort of tells us that we have a little different text type here all of a sudden. We don't just have poetry here for a brief insertion. It's like two sentences of kind of discourse rather than poetry. And this is just, I mean, this is just free, but one thing to realize is that our editors of the Bible are like very insightful, and so they can be a help to us, and that's really good. You know, like, these editors really know their stuff. They're not infallible. Like, one of the things that we saw in Micah was that they grouped together the verdict with the appeal from the people, and it was probably more helpful for them to set that apart by itself so that you recognize what's happening. They're not infallible. But anyway, great job. And then continue on. Mm.
And then in 14, I have 14 on its own that he's making a declaration.
I think this is really good. So you notice the shifts that take place. The only place that I would probably do things a little differently myself is I would connect the behold in 11 to the behold in 14, and I would group 11 to 14 together because of all of that. But I think this is really good because you can start getting at these shifts that take place And that leads you to be like, all right, well, at the beginning, you have opulence. In the middle, you have a promise of destruction. And then you have that promise intensified. And one of the things that you note as you work through all of this is that what is repeated in each of them is house. House here at the beginning, the kind of aspects of a house here in the middle. The house will crush you, and he will crush the house into bits. So it highlights the irony of the fact that these opulent houses in which the people of Israel are living are going to be brought down. Their opulence isn't going to spare them from a crushing of the house, which is Israel itself. And the structure itself can draw our attention to the irony of the exaltation of the people. You know, so they're high, they're like at the top of this mountain, and God's going to bring them down. He's going to crush this house. So, this is a very quick conclusion. But I just want to restate the principle before we conclude. We must discover the structure of a passage to discern its emphasis.